Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
This week on The Dev Team, Mark talks about accessibility and how to integrate it into our applications. I discuss the features of Node version 15, and Daryl wraps us up with writing high-quality code.
All right, well, I'm going to start us off today with a couple things. So word of the day is actually one that probably a lot of people, especially starting out as a junior developer, don't know or don't consider when they're trying to kind of rapidly build their applications. And a lot of times it gets even put to the afterthought of building applications, and that's accessibility. So accessibility is, you know, obviously it is in the word and kind of we use it in the normal definition. So it's not like it's a new definition, but basically making sure that your code and your site for that matter is accessible to people with any kind of, whether it's disability or some sort of impairment one way or the other. So kind of from a purely definition, it's that idea that it's, if I'm blind, how do I access your website? If I can't hear, how does that impact my experience on your website? If I have visual impairments, like color blindness and things like that, and how can we make sure that our sites are accessible to everyone? So I don't know if you guys have dealt much with adding accessibility or, you know, outside of maybe just the ARIA tag here and there, which is something valid worth talking about. Or I know Jake, you learned some kind of funny things about the voice when it comes to accessibility.
Yeah, so you can actually, believe it or not, and this is kind of a weird thing, I guess, to just kind of start that off with, but you can change the which voice a screen reader will use with CSS, of all things. So accessibility, it is huge. It is very important. Yes, I have actually done a decent amount with it. And it is one of those things that with today's modern tools and the settings and customizations that you can build, you can bake straight into your operating system. You can put it right into your actual browser settings. We should be able to kind of negate or override, custom websites, right? And I know that there's a lot of websites out there that, they want to have a particular look, right? Or there's a branding that you want to make sure that, hey, I'm using CodeWorks Blue, right? That's a pretty common thing that I want to do is make sure, hey, we've got CodeWorks Blue. But there are things that you can actually just tie directly into, and they are environment variables. When people hit your website, you can actually check different flags on an individual user's browser and deliver completely custom CSS options, right? And so we're doing that a lot now with like, oh, I prefer a dark theme mode or something of that nature, right? And like that's become a new crazy favorite, and probably largely driven by developers, right? But it's having the dark theme everywhere. True accessibility goes well beyond that. True accessibility is, yes, like you talked about, having those ARIA tags for every single image tag that you have on the page. You need to have your title and your alt tags there specified as well. And so there's a lot of things that you can actually do from an accessibility standpoint. And one of the things that I've actually done is there's website checkers, like you can check SEO and things of that nature. Of course, there's accessibility checkers where you just, plug in your website and it'll tell you kind of what your accessibility score is. So that's a pretty nice tool set there.
Yeah, I can't say that I've done like a ton with accessibility, but I have kind of gone through some of those checkers and things like that, and taking a look at what it takes to actually make your website truly accessible. I think there's a lot that goes into taking into account that kind of different user experience you want to provide for someone with a disability there. And so just simply putting in the attributes and things like that is great, but there's also probably a little bit more to kind of consider there. They're going to have a little bit different interaction with your website than your standard user, and so it might be worth taking a note or taking a look at.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it even comes down to things like, you know, motion or animation, right? Like, I know, how many developers do you know who have spent hours and hours and hours tweaking an animation so as you scroll, this thing looks really cool and it like fades and like rolls in or something of that nature. Like, that makes a lot of people, like, it gives them motion sickness. And so those are features or flags that should be able to be disabled, you know, and so be aware of those types of things. Make sure that your website still displays the image, you know, in the correct spot, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to this roll-in effect on scroll or something of that nature, right?
Another big piece to that is, like, you know, photosensitive seizures, right? Be aware of, like, flashing. Absolutely. Or anything that's, like, quickly, rapidly changing images or things like that that could trigger it. And the thing that's crazy is accessibility, it is a challenge for everybody. And a famous case, I don't know if you guys remember Domino's. Well, you remember Domino's as a company.
I mean, Domino's Pizza? Yes. I love it.
So
Domino's, visit that site weekly.
So Domino's Pizza actually got sued by someone who was blind because their app was not accessible, and they got sued for several millions of dollars. So, and Domino's, here's this like huge company, not necessarily known for their technology, but you know, very much someone who should have known better.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like I said, those checkers are out there for a reason. And as an education, like as a school, you know, we have certain requirements around accessibility as well, just for our main website. And I'll actually call out specifically, you know, we're big. We really like Vue around here, right? And so there's actually a framework called Vuetify. And one of the things that I think is the nicest thing about Vuetify is they have accessibility built directly into all of their components, right? So I can throw an input tag on the page and it's going to help provide all the ARIA tags and keep them up to date. And I don't really have to think too much about it, right? So there's plenty of solutions out there that can kind of help with accessibility if you just kind of, you know, pay attention to it when you're looking at those different front-end frameworks, you know, and trying to make that decision on what tooling should we use. You know, you do want to make sure that you are targeting those that need the extra help.
I would also just kind of lastly add, like, when you're picking a site theme colors, like, just consider that right out of the gate. Like, before I even go down the road of setting this as my theme colors, is this going to affect people with color blindness? And in that case, what do I do? Maybe you should consider different colors in the first place, or if you're in a boat where you can't, you have that kind of idea of how could I limit the frustration that people might have if that were the case.
Yeah, high contrast mode or, you know, color blindness mode, things of that nature, they exist for a reason. So,
all right, well, that's it for me. I will head off your news just a little bit, though, with my own news. So those of you listening to us, I have recently accepted, and so it won't be until November, but I will be actually doing a guest speaker at Vue Conference Toronto, which is a free virtual Vue conference. So something to look forward to. I'll maybe remind you in later podcasts, but hope you tune in and take a look at the talk.
Yeah, that's going to be a really great talk. I'm excited. And congratulations again for getting accepted there. That's pretty cool. Definitely newsworthy. And I think something we can, you know, I'm okay. You cut me off there. So in other news, slightly, you know, unrelated to Vue, but still in the JavaScript realm of things, did you know that Node has now officially released version 15?
That's awesome.
Which is really, really pretty cool. And, you know, we still don't necessarily have a modular code right out of the box, right? Like, we're still using ESM and other little tips and tricks there. That hasn't gone full release. But one of the biggest features, actually, with this newest version of Node is the Qwik protocol. And I don't know if you guys have any familiarity with Qwik or not, but we know the big rage that was, you know, HTTP converting over to HTTP2, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that was a big deal, and it was really important that your server could support HTTP2. It was a lot faster. I think Google released something they called, like, I can't remember what it was called. It was Speedy or something of that nature, right? Well, the new protocol under the hood that's now going to be supported with Node is Qwik, which is actually a UDP transport as opposed to a TCP transport.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. So of course, using UDP, we're talking about, differences in networking and all sorts of other stuff. And, you know, this is maybe a little more low level than what a lot of we deal with kind of at a surface level as web developers. But I think it's really important to understand kind of the underlying technology. And also with the release of any brand new protocol, I think, you know, that opens up a whole new gate of vulnerabilities that you should be paying attention to from a security standpoint, right? And so that's going to be something that I think we're going to be seeing a lot of over this next year, is the adaptation of HTTP3, and the transfer of everything over to QUIC, and the UDP protocol.
Absolutely. Less tested waters, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely less tested waters. And it makes me think, like, how many of those, pre-configured, network scanners, security sniffers that are sitting on people's networks, are they even ready for this type of change?
You're definitely falling into acronym land, I think, as soon as we kind of go into all this, right? So any of you looking this up, as a note, QUIC?
Yes. Sorry, I should have clarified there. Thank you, Mark.
Quick. It's also not an acronym, though it originally was, and I actually only found this out through Wikipedia, which I'm guaranteeing is 100% accurate. Thanks to my English teachers, they've told me that as well. I think that there's, again, definitely, it's like you said, a little bit low level, but good to keep your eye on things, especially as it comes to those attack vectors, right? Because we always talk to our students, even at their level, code like you're being attacked. Always expect your users to be either malicious or incredibly just destructive by nature. And as you transition into something like this, consider what maybe needs to change in the way you're accepting input and validating it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of the big news topic of the week. And one other feature that's coming out with Node 15 is the abort controller. And I'm not sure if you guys have seen anything of that nature, but we know that promises are great, right? Like in JavaScript land, we love promises. We love that, you know, something is going to guarantee to fail or succeed, right? But the problem that we've kind of had for a really long time is, what happens when you send out something that you know should be asynchronous, but you want to cancel it because something else occurs, right? You want to be able to abort a promise, and that's something that, you know, we should be able to do. And now, very fortunately, with the abort controller, Node will now natively support canceling of promises, so you don't necessarily have to always wait for resolution or a error. So that's, I would say, the other really big feature that I'm excited about with version 15.
I think that there's a lot of benefits to that for sure, because, you know, how many times is it like, hey, you know, I do need to handle whether it's a timeout or something like that. That whereas just like callbacks, you know, what happens if this never happens, right? How do I trigger that failure? So I think that that's definitely a big feature. I don't have a lot to add to that. I think that, you know, it's one of those things like there's the want to haves and need to haves and stuff. And you could have, prior to now, even set up your own style of failure within a promise, and it's basically going to be a timeout. But it's good to know that it's natively going to be supported now.
Yeah. And I'd say the other really big change that might be a good or might be a bad thing is unhandled rejection errors. Are now going to be thrown essentially to the top of the stack. And so hopefully, you know, hopefully you're not having too many unhandled exception errors in your servers that you're writing in Node land, but they're kind of promoting that model and kind of maturing it a little bit. So it'll act kind of like a more mature, kind of like C#.NET type style backend.
Yeah, that'll be really nice. I know that's something that we've addressed a lot as instructors, is making sure to provide that framework for our students, because that is a really big problem. You just get this really vague error or nothing at all, really, and you have no idea what's going on or what to work with. So that's going to be really, really nice. That's probably what I'm most excited for, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be nice for sure to be able to, you know, have those errors thrown up to the top of the stack and being able to handle those things. Cool. That's it for me. So we'll step over into deep dive, Daryl.
All right. Awesome. So this week, I kind of wanted to talk about writing high quality code and some of the principles and some practices and kind of tips based around that, tools you can use and things of that nature. It's a very important concept, and it's something that I think you can start working on at really any skill level, right? It's not something that's necessarily a skill, but more of a habit that you create. Using these same things, using these linters, using these tools, I can ensure that I'm always creating kind of this nice high-quality code. So one of the first things that I kind of thought of and wanted to bring up was modularity, right? Making sure that the code that you write is independent so that each chunk can kind of work by itself. This is really, really nice in the sense that when you go to have to rewrite a feature, you're focusing on just that feature and not all the little pieces that are now connected to it and all these little, you know, this, I like to think of it kind of when, like when I go fishing, when I cast out and I get all the string tangled up, right? Trying to cut all these pieces out. I don't know. That's just what I always think of my code when I go there. But
you mean the spaghetti ball?
The spaghetti ball.
The spaghetti code, right? As well. So that term follows over. I think that that's definitely something we've certainly addressed before too. When we talk about like abstraction or when we talk about plugins and all that different kind of stuff, is, you know, making your code isolate within its scope and kind of have those ins and outs that are a little bit more flexible. I've definitely made that mistake where things are really tightly coupled and it's like, okay, well, I'm really reliant on this array having at least one item in it. Oh crap, now it doesn't, and everything broken, everything's terrible. Whether it's, you know, just poor coding, and especially early on, right, we make those mistakes as things are tightly coupled and reliant upon, well, if this data doesn't exist, I guess it'll just crash.
Yeah, it's easy to create a dependency on a dependency on a dependency, and that's where you kind of run into this issue.
I was going to say, have you heard of Node? NPM? Dependencies upon dependencies?
That's like the inherent JavaScript problem, right? .NET, you go and install a package, and it's that package. And, you know, in JavaScript, you go and try to install a package, and, oh, look at updated 1,500 things. Neat. That's probably going to be bad.
I downloaded this one package, added 40 packages from 40 contributors.
Yeah, I would definitely say that there's, you know, and again, throwback to our very first episode, right? Like, appropriate levels of abstraction. It's really hard, but I think it's something that should be focused on, right? It's something that you should constantly be thinking about. And I always, I talk about this, especially in talking to brand new developers, is you're never going to write pre-refactored code, right? Like, write it, get it working, but as you're writing it, refactor as you go. Think about your problems, right? Like, write that code down, and if you can tell right away that you're doing something poorly, bare minimum, drop yourself a flag or a little note that says, hey, let's abstract this, right? Or just simply pull it into a new function, right? I can't even express how much of the cognitive complexity just drops if you take that line that you're about to write inside of that 15 line function already, just move it to a new function, call that, and then start thinking from there, right? Like, at least start with those baby steps, right? And I think you can very quickly, you'll start to identify, oh, look, I need to pass an argument. Oh, now I've realized I've passed the same argument in 15 different places. Oh, I probably have bad structure here.
I think the other thing that kind of falls within that, taking a couple steps back a little bit, and maybe you'll get to this eventually, Daryl, because I know you have a list this time, and so I'm hoping I can get one of the items later on the list, just as general payback. Don't bring in a package that does maybe 20 lines of code. I can't tell you how many times I'll see like juniors just pull in package after package after package after package, and it's like, cool, you brought in a package to do this one job, and if we actually go look at the source of this code, it's like 10 lines and a single function, and it does one thing. Just take that and put it in your code. There's no need for you to add a dependency when it's just easier to just do it. So I would also caution, yeah, be careful with just pulling stuff in. Anyone who's ever written in WordPress knows, like, plugin onto plugin onto plugin onto plugin onto plugin becomes completely unattainable.
Yeah, no, they talk about, you know, JavaScript, we talk about callback hell. PHP, we talk about plugin hell, right? But I would also caution you, like, if you are pulling in a package, right, understand what the complexity of that one function is, right? Like, that may look like, you know, three lines of code, but what it's doing could be a fairly complex thing, right? And, you know, there could be some other dependency that it has that it's calling on, right? So just be cautious of, you know, copying and pasting what looks like someone else's code into your own project to do something relatively simple that isn't simple.
Certainly don't. And I think that obviously comes back to, and maybe I'll hit one on here for you, Daryl. Maybe we'll see. Don't copy and paste code you don't understand. We've talked about that one before too.
Yep, I've got a little bit on that in here.
All right, we'll let you get your next point two.
and so the other thing is going right to that, readability. Making sure your code is clean, has correct syntax and spacing and things of that nature. So really nice tools for that are linting, right? Kind of static code analysis there. No unused code. That's probably my big one, especially for students. Like, that's the thing that maybe drives me the most nuts or is the biggest pet peeve, is when someone goes and just says, well, I'm not using this function anymore, but I might need it later and let me comment it out. I can't tell you like how much that bothers me.
The code dragons, right? Like, yeah, you're keeping your hoard of unused variables. You have this hoard of functions that do nothing. No one ever calls it, right? Like, use those linters, use your IDE. If there are no references to a function anymore, remove it, right? Check it into source control first, make sure it's been checked in at least one time, but then remove that junk, right? I also love it, hate it, right? When a student, you look at their file and they've got 600 lines of code just commented out, right? That's just as bad as leaving it in there. Like, rip out those comments, right? When they're just big commented out chunks of code, like that does not need to be there.
That's how you end up with one of those Chesterton's fence, right? Nobody knows what this used to do. Could be doing something, leave it in there. Anyways, one of the other things to kind of go with that, like you were saying, Mark, copy and pasting, talking about dry here, right? Do not repeat yourself. I find that so often people are just really willing, especially students or new developers, they're really willing to say, well, I need this exact functionality. Let me just go copy it and paste it over into here. The moment you do that, you know there's a better way to kind of abstract this and reutilize this thing in one singular spot that you have to maintain.
If you can build a guilty conscience for every time you copy and paste your own code, like, again, that should immediately be like, oh God, I feel gross, right? You get those just, ugh, this, I know this is going to work, but it feels bad and it feels wrong. But this is kind of comes back to what Jake said, right? Refactor as you go. Sometimes that's a, hey, let me copy and paste this to make sure it works here. Okay, it does. Great. Now let me clean it up. And how can I look at these two times I've used that same bit of code and modify it to maybe take in a single parameter that's the one thing that changes, or a bool that flips basically one piece of functionality.
I want to call out specifically, you said copy and paste your own code, right? You can still copy and paste from Stack Overflow, right? Like, you're an excellent developer when you copy and paste from Stack Overflow. But
no, that's valid. That's valid.
So I do think it's, if you are copying and pasting your own code, or right, code from one file into another file, right? Like, to me, that just immediately shows either a lack of awareness, a lack of care, maybe a lack of familiarity with the language. There's definitely better ways of handling that than, you know, don't just copy and paste chunks of code around. I also love it when you see, here's an error, but that's not the problem I'm dealing with right now. I solved this other thing, but I have this error over here. I had to call that out just because.
Oh yeah, no, that's I see that all the time, right? Maybe that's on your list or maybe it's not. But when you're debugging, it's very much that, like, hey, if you have an error in your console, solve it. Maybe that thing is the thing that's preventing your later process. So many times I see, oh well, we've had that error for the last hour, and this worked before and now it doesn't. Cool, great, fix that problem. And lo and behold, oh, it turns out that thing caused a trickle-down effect of cascading breaks that did eventually affect you.
Yeah, and I just one more thing to tack in there is, you know, that's that as you're refactoring, right, or as you're trying to clean up your code, or if you're trying to, you know, fix things, fix one problem at a time and test. Fix one problem at a time and test, right? Too often I've seen people be like, oh, I've just spent, you know, 2.5 hours refactoring all of my code and now my application doesn't work again. It's like, I have no idea why, right? Like, so don't do that to yourself when you're in that process of refactoring.
Absolutely. Those are all great things. And those kind of, I like that, how you guys phrased all of that, because that really goes back and kind of emphasizes that all of these things are really just habits, right? It's not really a skill that you're going to develop. It's more of a habit. Writing it, you know, maybe not necessarily the greatest way first, and then going back and refactoring, just making sure to put that refactoring into the process, making that part of your habit. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about that kind of goes with this one as well, I mean, these do all tie in together pretty well, but reusability. So this is kind of getting back to the modularity, but it doesn't have to necessarily be modules, right? This can be different aspects of your current project, all in the same project, and things that you've kind of abstracted away, or even dependencies and packages. Try to use those as much as you can, especially since if you write something, you know, a really, really nice tool or feature in one project, it's really nice to be able to kind of just pull that into another project, not have to go through that same process of figuring this out, solving this thing, and debugging it and getting it working again.
I think a lot of this has, like, that exactly right there is probably 90% of the NPM packages and NuGet packages that we published. It's more of a, hey, I figured this thing out. It was a pain, but it works really great. And now I want to use it again and again. And I have a bunch of projects I think this is going to be applicable in. Time to publish to NPM. They don't charge you anything. You can make a public one and then bring in your own NPM package, because I know, hey, this is, you know, we just did this the other day with some auth stuff. Hey, it took us like 4 or 5 hours to put this auth tool together. Let's publish it for ourselves so I don't have to go through that headache anymore. It's accessible, it's modularized, it's small, it takes a couple of variables for the input, and then it just works.
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes with like code maturity, right? Having some experience in the field, you have to understand a lot of the topics that we've talked about, you know, throughout this entire podcast season, and, you know, being able to know when and where to abstract, right? Being able to say, okay, I have this really nice tool. I want to be able to reuse it. I need to make sure that I've removed any external, you know, dependencies that can't be injected. Does that make sense? And now I'm just, again, I'm using dependency injection. we're using complex topics here. So again, I would point out that it's a skill that comes in time. But there are little things that you can do along the ways. And it goes back to that, you know, when you're about to write that one line of code, just write a new function, right? Little things like that will get you down that path, or at least get you started down that path of knowing when and where and how to abstract correctly.
Yeah, and this can even be started like when you write your third project ever and you're like, man, that was a super sweet nav bar I made in the last one. I'm just going to keep using this template, you know, right? Things like that work too, so.
I think that to kind of build on Jake's a little bit too, like, understand that a lot of this does come time and repetition, like you said, building habits and kind of all that. Don't expect that you're going to be able to become an expert developer. Hey, here's the 5 tips I learned on the dev team, and now I'm an excellent developer. No, these are habits. These are practices. These are things you have to build over time, and there's no shortcutting it. You can't, you know, we teach as best as we can to the students, and that's maybe comes with that mentorship from an extent. If you don't have like a coding bootcamp or a formal education background, you know, finding that mentor who can help you identify these good habits and building them, but it just takes time.
Yeah, that is a great thing to point out. You don't just sit down one day after having written, you know, let's call it what it is, a terrible project, and then decide, okay, the very next one, this is going to be some high quality code, right? It just does not happen that way. So you definitely have to work on these habits.
High quality garbage.
Yeah.
that's what we shoot for every time.
I do have that plaque on my desk, solidly average.
Solidly average.
That's why I shoot for applications that are solidly average.
I mean, we joke about that, but I think you can lean in a little bit to that concept of, you know, the first time you write something, and I think we've even said, and if not, Mark, I'm going to steal your words, but the very first time you write something, right? It's not ready for production. I promise, right? Like, do not turn in your rough draft as your final draft, I think is kind of the thing that Mark has said for a long time. You know, take that extra little bit of time to review your project, review the code that you wrote, you know, and just sit back and say, does this look good? You know, is it abstracted? Do I have functions that are more than 10 lines of code, right? Like, there's little tips and tricks, and, you know, there's excellent tools out there that can do, you know, the static code analysis. They can do code quality checks. They can do all those other different types of things. Trust that those tools are there for a reason. And, you know, maybe take one of your terrible projects, right? And just simply point one of these code analysis tools at it and just go through the suggestions. You know, it might be a decent way to start.
Yeah, I think that's a great tipping point for my next topic here as well, kind of a more of a practice, if you will. Test-driven development. So this is a process. I'm not going to go through all of it right now. This is a topic all on its own. Some people really don't like it. Some people really do.
As Jake makes faces.
Yeah. And I could get that. It's truly, it can be looked at as like the pessimistic approach to development, right? Let me find all the things that can go wrong with my code or why my code's so terrible. But it's also, it can also help with some of those little things, right? Every step of the way, it's building that habit of, let me go back and make sure this is ready to go. Let me refactor here. Let me insert this process of, once I get to this point, this is typically where I've made some bad choices. Let me go back and look at it. Let me fix these up. I find if I don't kind of follow some sort of mix of that, I'll write a lot of lines of code and I'll end up regretting it later and starting over again, usually.
I find that, you know, from a testing standpoint, whether it's, you know, TDD or just writing tests in general, it helps me think about after the fact. Like, I put myself in a different mindset than when I'm writing the code to solve a problem. I'm now saying, okay, how can I break the solution I was given? And in that alone, you build the practice of preemptively starting to write better code. So even starting and doing some tests early on, and then maybe you're not doing as many down the road, which you definitely should, but I think we all kind of in that boat, like, I should write more tests. But I think that the reality of the situation, right, there's that ideal and then there's reality. The reality of the situation is the more you have written tests, the better your code will be afterwards, because you're already thinking ahead and you're already planning ahead, like, okay, you know, I know from previous tests I've written, this breaks when I do XYZ. So let me code around that problem preemptively.
It's like we were just talking about a few minutes ago, is assume that your users are malicious or just somehow incredibly destructive and are always going to do what you don't expect them to do, right? And that's kind of that concept there behind that test-driven development. You know, let's handle our edge cases. And I only make faces and, you know, groan because, you know, it takes you a little bit out of the mindset of a developer that I'm going to build something, right? Because it makes you step back and say, okay, I need to conceptualize first what I'm going to build, right? And sometimes, especially as developers, we get used to these tools that allow us to just create these amazing things and we'd want to just go create, right? But then we don't put a firm structure underneath it and it all falls to pieces anyways. So, you know, you really ought to start with, you know, the concepts behind test-driven development for sure. And I know that. I just, you know, don't always prefer it.
But I think the big thing to kind of keep in mind, too, is like, what are you writing? What's the code you're writing, right? Are you building a side project just for fun? Or is this your work corporate app, enterprise-level monolith, right? Because you definitely are going to have tests in the latter.
It's definitely the 80-20 rule, right? And that comes into play there entirely. And if you're not familiar with that 80-20 rule, it's, you know, let's cover at least at 80% the things that are crucially important, right, type of thing. So.
Yeah, I think you guys identified really well the two kind of differences there, or the two mindsets there. Like Mark was saying, is you do have to think as the developer, and Jake is saying that, you know, that's the creative part and that's the fun part, and then you get to go on to the not so fun part where you're like, all right, somebody's going to try to break my code. Here's all the ways that might happen, and so that's a good thing to consider for sure.
Like when I'm building out my map on a real-time strategy game, I'm like, okay, I'm going to put these houses here. Here's a neighborhood. Oh, now I have a power plant. Let's just put that next to these houses. It's a good thing I'm not a city planner.
What could go wrong? And then some of the other tools that you could use is Code Climate, right? So this is kind of a code review program, or it's a little more automated. There's different things that you can access through that. I haven't used Code Climate as much as I probably should. I typically have more of my code review through a continuous integration, something of that nature, which I'll talk about kind of in a second. But Jake, have you, you've kind of used Code Climate a little more, I'd say?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very specific tool, right? Like specific company tool. But what's really nice there is it integrates just fine with GitHub, and you can point it at any public repository and it's free, right? And it will just analyze your code and then give you a whole bunch of suggestions on, hey, you could do this to make your code better, right? And it actually gives you a letter grade, right? And nothing makes you feel worse when you feel really cool about a project and you submit it to something like Code Climate and tells you, you got a D on that assignment, right? But here's how you could turn it into an A, right? And that's what I really like about it is it. I mean, most production environments are going to put some sort of letter grade minimum, but I usually shoot for at least a B, right?
Yeah, I would say that mine usually go from a D right to an A because it usually goes, hey, this isn't dry, and there's about 42 instances of that, so I just go change that one thing, and hey, suddenly I'm in an A.
Yeah, it's really great. I also want a fancy tool of it. If you're a junior dev out there, if you're a senior dev, cover your ears for a second. But it actually tells you that, hey, this problem that you have is expected to take X number of hours to complete. And so you can tell your boss, look, I need 15 hours to refactor my code. That's what Code Climate says.
It's like really four lines to change.
I mean, it's a pretty decent tool, but it does have some of those little gotchas in there that are pretty funny. Probably your final topic here, Daryl.
Yep. That would be continuous integration. This is kind of my preferred choice. I usually go in there and I have some sort of testing or code analysis that I want to have happen that just in general keeps my code a little bit cleaner. Maybe a linting process that I need to make sure always happens so everything stays formatted the same. And so every time I push, this just happens. If I did something wrong or, I'm not writing clean enough code, it's just going to come back and it's going to fail and it's not going to go into the branch I want it to. And so then I have to kind of review and clean that up right then and there. I choose to do that for myself because I know if I don't do that and I just push it, I will never go back again and actually do that. If I don't ever make time for refactoring, it just won't happen.
100%, right? Those built-in tools can be incredibly nice. And it comes back to that idea that Jake wasn't crazy about, but obviously we know there's production versus this is a fun project, right? And I know 100% Jake is usually the one who does the setup process that for all this for our team. And it's, setting those rules to make sure, hey, let me know and be mean to my future Mark because future Mark is going to be lazy. And so let me make sure future Mark can't be lazy making good decisions now, such as those branching or the merge rules and the pull request requirements of reviews and et cetera, because, ultimately that's what does happen. We do get in a hurry and we make mistakes and we just push those mistakes and it'll be fine. And, setting up some of those rules really makes you really stop and think, am I okay pushing this to production if all these tests are failing?
Yeah, and I think the thing that's nice there is invest the time at least once up front, save it as a template before you move any further, and then you have a template that you can pull for all of your future projects and problems and things of that nature. And so that's, I think, and again, I can't remember. I think you called this topic like pro code or something of that nature, like how to be an expert developer or something of that nature.
Writing high quality code.
High quality code. You don't start there, right? Like all these things take time, energy, effort. They take a process. They take a decent amount of time to invest up to and towards. And so, that's one of those things. It's going to take you a while to get that first template off the ground. It's going to take you a while to even figure out how do you create different branches? How do you do this? How do you do that? Right? Like, but you invest that time once. And the thing that's nice about it is when you're talking about project overall, or project overhauls, you can set those types of things up and that, investment is a one-time thing. And then you get to benefit from it. Everywhere else.
All that creates that maintainability of your code, and that's what produces the high quality code.
One more thing I just have to throw in here. If you're listening, we are going to be doing a CodeWorks download, which is a specialized Vue training with integrating Auth0 that is set to launch November 7th, I believe. And if you follow us on the different media sources, you should be able to see a link to sign up for that if it's something you're interested in. So sorry, just had to kick that one out there real fast.
No problem, no problem. Well, again, thank you again for joining us here on the podcast. Be sure to follow up with us by liking and subscribing on whatever podcast network you're following us on. Again, check us out on CodeWorks on Facebook, or check out our CodeWorks main page for current events or things coming up. And until we see you again, happy coding.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at boisecodeworks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from the Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.